Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Republican leadership's breathtaking hypocrisy as they feign indignation over remarks made by Congressman Todd Akin that are identical to the views contained in the Republican platform now being prepared for next week's convention. Joining us is Jody Jacobson, the president and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, where she has an article, "As Romney and Ryan Dissemble, RNC Prepares Radical Anti-Choice Platform Based on Personhood." Then we'll examine Syria's chemical weapons arsenal and its possible proliferation or use, which President Obama has warned is a red line that would provoke intervention. Raymond Zelinskis, a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq who now directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Program at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies, joins us. He has an article in The National Interest, "Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons." Then finally, we will speak with David Sassoon, the publisher of InsideClimateNews.org, about Dilbit, a thick tar that is diluted with chemicals so that it can move through pipelines. He has an article in Tuesday's New York Times, "Crude, Dirty, and Dangerous," and we will discuss the hazards associated with transporting up to one quarter of our future oil supply across America from the Canadian tar sands to Texas via the Keystone XL pipeline that will be carrying the dirty and dangerous Dilbit. And joining us now is Jody Jacobson, a longtime leader in the health and development community and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. She's currently president and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, where she just wrote the article, "As Romney and Ryan Dissemble, RNC Prepares Radical Anti-Choice Platform Based on Personhood." Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Jacobson.
Thank you for having me.
And I must say, I'm watching, it's hard to keep up with the hypocrisy and lies that the Republican campaign have been doing since day one, in particular Mitt Romney. And it's just breathtaking to watch them try and spin this current situation that's been brought about by Representative Todd Akin and his extraordinary remarks that were an incredible combination of misogyny and ignorance. And they, of course, the entire Republican establishment, including Fox News' Hannity, who appears to be an unofficial advisor, they're all weighing in, trying to get this guy to drop out of the race because they figure they're going to lose the Senate seat in Missouri that they thought they had in the bag. This is so transparently all about holding onto a Senate seat or not losing a Senate seat they thought they were going to win. And everybody is sort of huffing and puffing about what a terrible statement it is. But apparently what this guy said is exactly what the Republican platform is going to say and is what they're writing at this very moment down in Tampa.
Yes. I mean, I think, first of all, you're absolutely correct that they're concerned about the Senate seat. There's no question about that. I think they're also concerned about the fact that the more that these questions persist about what he said and how he sort of stepped in it for the GOP, it raises awareness of, people's awareness that both Romney and Ryan basically support the same exact policies as are being written into the GOP platform, as Akin has already described them. I mean, Ryan and Akin together were co-sponsors of and voted on a bill to actually change the definition of rape in line with what Akin was discussing the other day. So this is not a strange thing to Paul Ryan, and I think that Romney and Ryan really don't want that conversation to be happening.
Well, if you've written in your article, Jody Jacobson, at RH Reality Check, "As Romney and Ryan Dissemble, RNC Prepares Radical Anti-Choice Platform Based on Personhood," you've written that Ryan is Akin without the political Tourette syndrome.
Right.
He was an original co-sponsor of the bill to redefine rape and to let Catholic hospitals deny women's care, and he also is co-sponsor of the Sanctity of Human Life Act. Now, how is that going to be worked into the platform, the Sanctity of Human Life Act, and what are the consequences of it?
Well, the platform as we now see it already includes the language on supporting a constitutional amendment for declaring the sanctity of human life of the quote-unquote unborn child. And what the technical and legal and policy meaning of that is that once an egg and a sperm have united to be, you know, make a fertilized egg, and even before it implants in the uterus, you will have be considered to be carrying a person if you are a woman who in which that fertilized egg is floating. And so as of that moment, that fertilized egg has all the rights of a living, breathing human person, and in fact, its rights will trump your own rights. So that the effect of that, practically speaking, is to not only ban all abortions for any reason whatsoever, but also to ban many forms, commonly used forms of hormonal birth control, the IUD, to ban in vitro fertilization, to criminalize miscarriage. There are a whole range of sort of cascading effects of this kind of law. And it's the very kind of law that has been rejected, otherwise known as a personhood amendment, has been rejected in states like Missouri and Colorado by resounding margins because people came to understand exactly what the implications were. So that is really those are the implications of this human life amendment. And, you know, not only has this become part of the platform, but Mitt Romney was very clear in several of the statements and during the debates of the primaries that he would sign such an amendment if it were passed. So, you know, there you have it.
So the idea that his vice president, Paul Ryan, is on the same page as Aiken, they've co-sponsored a lot of bills together, and they share the same belief that there can be no exceptions for abortion, and they both, as far as I know, are even against birth control. You have the Republican Party preparing its platform with all of these radical bills all rolled in to the platform. And then you've got Romney having in the primary debates said that he would sign a personhood bill. But the other day, in response to Aiken, he came out and basically said that he's against the whole idea of, he thought that was offensive, the remarks, but he does believe in the exception, abortion exception for rape and incest and the life of the mother. So is this just some kind of kabuki we're watching here? If his own vice president and the party believe one thing and he goes along with 99% of it, his only exception is that in the case of abortion, he will make an exemption for the life of the mother, rape and incest. Is that where he stands? Because I'm not entirely sure where he does stand.
The question of where he stands is really the question of the day. I mean, you know, what you've had and what we've tried to document on our site is the fact that Mitt Romney sort of transmogrified from a somewhat pro-choice governor into an extremely anti-choice presidential candidate over the past 5 years. And he has said so many different things. I am beginning to believe he doesn't even understand. There are certain times when I believe Mitt Romney is saying things he doesn't even understand the implications of what he's talking about, because he's so eagerly, if you watch some of these tapes from the debates, he's asked about things like, you know, a human life amendment. He so eagerly says, yes, yes, I'll sign that. Of course I would. And then comes out with statements like, no, of course I would allow exceptions. I don't really know if his team or he understands what he says he's signing onto. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, let's say that all politicians are somewhat opportunistic. Mitt Romney is nothing if he's not opportunistic, and he seems to feel no compunction about changing his position on things from one day to the next. I think you've seen a very similar pattern of shifting back and forth with regard to Ryan's budget plan and whether his plan is the same as Ryan's plan, quite different than Ryan's plan, actually the same as, I mean, from one day to the other, you can look at interviews that actually bounce back and forth between those. So I think this is his tendency, is that he so has his finger in the wind, and he so realizes that, A, he's got a gender gap, B, he's picked a vice presidential candidate he didn't think was going to be embroiled in an anti-choice debate, and C, he's now staked out some pretty extreme positions that he is not even sure of the consequences of.
Again, I'm speaking with Jodi Jacobson, a longtime leader in the health and development community and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. She's currently president and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, where she just wrote the article, "As Romney and Ryan Dissemble, RNC Prepares Radical Anti-Choice Platform Based on Personhood." Now, Romney did fairly recently on the stump say that he would get rid of Planned Parenthood, categorically.
Yeah.
So Planned Parenthood, apparently, even though there's been this obsession about their role in abortion, that is, I think, only about 3% of what they do. And they certainly don't spend any government funds because that's against the law and has been for some time with the Hyde Amendment. They, as far as I know, do a lot of testing, you know, pap smears and stuff like that, screen for cancer, etc. And they offer contraception. That seems to be their big sin, if you will. He's pretty clear on that one, isn't he? So can't somebody out there ask him categorically, whether Romney, whether he's against contraception? Because if he wants to shut down Planned Parenthood, that's largely what they do, as far as I know. Isn't that a logical question to ask him?
It's a very logical question. And I personally believe that both of these candidates, you know, all the candidates, I really think all of the candidates, frankly, should be regularly asked very probing questions on these issues. I think too often what happens is that they get asked questions, you know, a single question, you know, oh, do you support contraception? And, you know, you can say, oh, sure, you know, I support people being able to use contraception. But, you know, you then have to follow up with, well, how do you, you know, in your budget, or how do you in your political stance ensure that low-income women and women living in poverty get access to reproductive health care, including contraception? You know, how do you, if you're going to cut off all Planned Parenthood funding, where are those services going to come from? Someone might ask, okay, in Texas, they cut off Planned Parenthood, and they said they would replace all of the services with their own existing clinics. In fact, there are no clinics that exist to provide those services, and women are now without them. How will you deal with that? These are the kinds of very specific questions I don't hear people asking, and those are the real-life consequences of these policies.
So is this just a problem that you have a candidate who's basically comes out of the business world and is running for CEO of America, and he wants to manage America rather than lead America, and that he sees the press as something that can be managed by his vice president in charge of public affairs? Is that, I mean, he's so hard, they have so few real exchanges with him. When they do, they're usually pretty safe venues and nobody much gets into any real substance. Is this what we're stuck with, just a feckless press?
A very managed candidate. And I think, you know, it's going to be critically important that the interviewers in the debates and other venues really ask hard questions. And I just don't see them being asked very frequently. But as you said, I think they also don't make themselves available to ensure that those questions are asked. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us, I don't care if it's Democrat, Republican, or, you know, the Green Spaghetti Monster, that we all be very clear that we want our candidates to be transparent and be asked hard questions.
And the whole point of this conversation is that there's not much difference, if any, between the attitudes of Todd Akin, the congressman, who talked about legitimate rape as opposed to real rape, and had this peculiar idea about women's bodies. And what was interesting about his Taliban-like formulation and prognostication was that he keeps referring to women's bodies, not the women.
Right, exactly.
They're not persons.
Exactly.
They're just things. But what is really shocking is that this guy, Akin, is on the science committee. I mean, this is, you know, he's a perfect exemplar of anti-science based upon his extraordinary ignorant ideas about reproductive health. But the long and the short of it is there's no difference between this guy and Paul Ryan and the platform that the Republican Party is now drafting in Tampa, which they're going to run on. I mean, obviously, the candidate can always sort of try and wiggle out of it. But what does this say? I mean, you know, he's running to be the head of a party and a country, and he doesn't want to acknowledge how much he is connected to this party? I mean, hello?
I think that, you know, I always have in my head the question of why does X and such person want to be elected, want to be president, want to be whatever? You know, what is it they really are doing that for? Why is it that Mitt Romney actually wants to be president? Is it because he thinks it's a glorious position or what have you, or what is driving him? Because from my vantage point, you know, I have to say, there has been almost no position that he has ever taken that he hasn't changed in order to be president. So it's not like there is a driving force inside of him and a core set of beliefs, and certainly not a core set of beliefs around women's rights in the public sphere to which he is, you know, holds allegiance. And I think because of that, it's very suspect that, you know, he will take any position that will get him elected. And that's what worries me. And it would worry me about a Democrat or a Republican, a state candidate, a Senate candidate, what have you. I always feel very nervous when people are so willing to change their positions and change their positions in ways that are so obviously against what the science and the evidence say.
Well, I can tell you why he's running for president, Jody Jacobson, because he loves America.
Well, I suppose.
I'm serious.
In his own way.
No, that's what that's as much as he said. I mean, I think it's an incredibly important question to ask him. Why are you doing this? I mean, it seems to me that what's actually happening here is he's running this campaign like a leverage buyout in venture capital, and he will say anything to close the deal. That's
exactly
what it's about. I mean, but he doesn't say why he wants to close this deal and what he wants to do with the deal once he's closed it. I mean, that's the part that's so extraordinary.
Exactly.
It's
that's
sort
exactly
of
right.
Ambition without purpose, you know?
Ambition without purpose. I think that's exactly right.
So I understand that the Republicans are the daddy party and the Democrats are the mummy party, and 60% of American women vote Democrat and 60% of American males vote Republican, and that seems to be the divide. So, you know, I don't know whether you can, the women of this country on the Republican side are affected by this or whether it concerns them, but they're certainly not saying anything. But what about the young women who voted in 2008? One of the things that I understand about this race is that if Obama were to get the same number of votes he got in 2008, we wouldn't be having a discussion. It would be a walk. There'd be nothing to discuss in this campaign. But there's a great deal of doubt as to whether the young people, in many ways, who put Obama over the top by a wide margin last time, are sitting this out. So what's going on with young women? Don't they realize that in a very short period, if these people get in, these kind of American Taliban types, who really seem to be more obsessed with this stuff than anything else, it's their legislative priority. So the minute they get into power, they're going to enact all of this stuff, and we'll have this bizarre country, this patchwork of red and blue states where you'll have young women in red states going to Greyhound bus stations to travel to blue states to get abortions, and there'll be Christian vigilantes checking for their papers, and all of this weird stuff that's going to happen here, because this is obviously an obsession that a lot of people have about other people's bodies.
I think that young women, you know, the category of sort of young women, are very energized and very aware of what's happening to them with these policies and the options that they have that are being foreclosed. I also think that there are other issues. You know, for example, I heard that in the party platform committee there were a number, today in the GOP, a number of younger Republicans who were raising the issue of wanting to include marriage equality as a part of the plank for the Republican Party, who were shut out by older, more established power brokers in the Christian right. And so I think, you know, to some extent, there's a sort of dichotomy between what the Republican Party stands for and the fact that younger voters don't agree with those positions and the sort of rejection of them and their ideas outright, and the effects of these policies on real people. I mean, there are real effects for example, college students and young women entering the labor force and low-income women who are in their 20s, of the kinds of policies that have been promoted by the GOP, and I think they know that, and they will be out there. Now, you know, whether between the issues of that Obama has had in terms of generating excitement for this election and also things like voter ID and so forth, whether those things will have a counter effect, I can't say.
Well, Jody Jacobson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jody Jacobson, who's a longtime leader in the health and development community and an advocate with extensive experience in public health, gender equity, human rights, environment, and demographic issues. She's currently president and editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, where she just wrote the article, "As Romney and Ryan Dissemble, RNC Prepares Radical Anti-Choice Platform Based on Personhood." We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a former weapons inspector and expert in chemical weapons. We're looking into what Syria has and what's going to happen to Syria's WMD.
Hey, beautiful bird, I said, digging her somber mood. The fascists are some heavy dudes. They don't really give a damn about life. They just don't want a woman to control her body or have the right to choose. But baby, that ain't nothing. They just want a male finger on the button. Because if you say war, they will send them to die by the score. Aborting mission should be your volition, but if Sudan and Thomas have their way, you'll be standing.
Time and time and time we see these acts against humanity. Well, each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see and some won't be. Sounds so hard. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Raymond Zielinskas, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He was a United Nations Special Commission Weapons Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense, Offense and Defense. And his latest book is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. He has an article in the National Interest, Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raymond Zielinskas.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be with you once again.
And not under the best of circumstances, given that the Syrian government fairly recently went public and acknowledged their possession of chemical weapons, saying that they would use them if outside forces intervene, but pledging not to use them within the country. What you're suggesting in your article in the National Interest, that in making that statement, in effect, the Syrian regime did break the Geneva Convention, or the Geneva Protocols. They're not signatory to the Chemical Weapons Convention, but they are signatories to the Geneva Protocol, which is in full text is the prohibition of the use in war of asphyxiating, poisonous, and other gases, and of bacteriological methods of war. That's the official definition. So you're arguing that they've already, in effect, violated the Geneva Protocols.
No, I'm saying that a decision has to be made at the Security Council level whether that is enough to activate the Geneva Protocol. All of the investigations that the Secretary General has so far been involved in, and there have been 12 of them, all of them have been to investigate events that had taken place. So here we have a situation where the Syrians are saying we are going to use them under certain circumstances. So I think that this is enough for the Security Council to say we need an intervention here by the UN Secretary General.
And how would you envision this taking place?
I would say that the Secretary General has the power to put together an investigative team and dispatch them to the border of Syria, probably of Turkey, and demand that they be given entry. So, at that point, the Syrian government would have to make a decision whether to say yes or no. Now, we know that they have said yes before for the humanitarian observers to come in. So there is a precedent for UN people coming into Syria.
So at this point, based upon what the president said in his press briefing on Monday, he warned Syria about crossing a red line, and that he was saying that we're seeing a whole bunch of weapons moving around, or when we start seeing a whole bunch of weapons moving around or being utilized, that would change my calculus, that would change my equation, meaning that that would be, I guess, a tripwire for intervention. How do you read it?
Yes, I read that, and I don't know exactly what this intervention would be like. First of all, you know, the chemical weapons that the Syrians are supposed to have, and I believe they do, how would they use them? You know, if they use it against the insurgents often are part of the population. So, and chemical weapons are a very, very, I should say, broad weapon. They're not exact at all. So would they then use it against insurgents that are inside communities, inside cities, and also therefore put the whole population at risk? Would they do that like the Saddam Hussein did against the Kurds and Halabja in 1988? And that it's not at all clear if they would actually do that. But the other thing is, would they use it against, should we say, some like the Israelis or the foreign source, if they saw them that they were being threatened? I mean, that so far they're not being directly threatened by foreign forces. So it's really not clear at all to me what President Obama is saying. What is the actual tripwire? And to my mind is that really we should keep out of it as much as possible. And I hope the Israelis keep out of it as much as possible and let the United Nations handle it.
Again, I'm speaking with Raymond Zielinskas, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He was a United Nations Special Commission Weapons Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense. And his latest book is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. He has an article at the National Interest, Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. But you mentioned Iraq, and you were a weapons inspector in Iraq, Ray Zielinskas. The long and short of it is that Saddam lobbed a bunch of Scud missiles at Israel that had next to no military utility, but he was trying to draw Israel into that war. So I think the scenario that concerns people is that that Assad, in his desperation, might use chemical weapons to draw Israel in and therefore legitimize himself. Do you see that as a possible scenario?
Yes. First of all, of course, the Saddam Hussein's missile Scuds did not have any chemical warheads.
No, if they had, he would have gotten nuclear weapons and lobbed on him in return, wouldn't he?
Right. But the situation, I think, is quite different. There you had full warfare in Iraq. So the Allied forces or the coalition forces were on the point of invading Iraq, and there was a full war. We don't have that here in Syria. It's not at all, we don't know, we can't read Assad's mind. he might not think that he's really in a terminal position. In other words, that his regime or his government is ready to fall. We just don't know that. So what you're talking about, I think, is kind of like a last step. Everything is going to hell for him. He's ready to fall. And then now he tries the desperate shot, step of throwing Scud missiles with chemical warheads at the Israelis. I mean, that's one possibility, and that would be a very, very frightful situation, because the Israelis obviously would have to do something. But then you also have to think about that if the Israelis did something, you would probably end up with a regional-wide conflict, and that's not something I think anybody wants.
Now, I understand that the U.S. has a lot of sensors and overhead imagery going on over Syria, both documenting human rights abuses and tracking these depots. There's supposed to be a number of depots that have been identified that have where they think the chemical weapons are stored. And I guess if they're watching them closely, if any movement of these weapons take place, I'm wondering whether that's the red line. You know, I think the fear is, that's been expressed by Israel, is that they don't want these weapons to end up in the hands of either Al-Qaeda, who are a part of the Free Syrian Army, and Hezbollah, which, of course, is a sworn enemy of Israel.
Yes, that's correct. First, so far, the estimate that there's 24 sites. So there's a lot of sites to cover. And then we don't know what kind of mixture those sites have of conventional weapons and chemical weapons. So it's very difficult to tell from afar whether an artillery shell contains chemicals or conventional explosives. And the same thing with rockets. The Syrians are self-sufficient in short-range rockets. In other words, rockets that have a range of between 50 and 150 miles. So, and again, who knows really, unless you're right there, whether that's rockets have chemical warheads or conventional warheads. So there must be something that indicates to the watching Americans in the satellites and maybe YouTubes that this is chemical weapons that are being moved. But I don't really know for sure if that's such an accurate way to estimate whether or not chemical warfare is ready to be used by the Syrians. Again, a very, very difficult situation. And what are they going to use the chemical weapons for? Now, if the Scuds are being readied, that's a different situation, because you need launch pads for them. Again, it's going to be probably not possible to tell whether the Scuds have chemical warheads or if they have conventional warheads. But if Scuds are being readied, it can only be against a foreign opponent like by Israel, because you couldn't use the Scuds just wouldn't be precise enough to be used against internal forces.
So, do we know what chemicals they have? Do they have sarin?
The thinking is that they have VX, sarin, and mustard.
And any biological?
No, that's highly hypothetical. The Swedish Defense Research Institute has some years ago came out with a study saying that they certainly had some capabilities to do research and development in this field, but they didn't have any biological weapons. And then a few years later, the American general that was testifying before Congress saying that they definitely had research and development pertaining to biological weapons, and they were close to having them, but he couldn't tell for sure whether they actually had biological weapons. And I think that's probably as close as we are right now to knowing. My own feeling is that it's pretty dubious that they have actual biological weapons on the shelf, especially in view of them having really a large quantity of chemical weapons.
Well, just in closing, Raymond Zelenskis, my understanding from and the New York Times has been reporting on this, is that the Pentagon has contingency plans in a worst-case scenario, but these involve tens of thousands of American troops, apparently, who've been trained in chemical warfare and, in I guess, in neutralizing chemical arsenals. But this whole thing is so murky. If the satellites pick up them deploying Scuds, that would immediately invite an air attack, I would think. But how can you send troops in, and presumably they have to protect them, to neutralize these weapons or to capture them before, say, Hezbollah or Al Qaeda gets hold of them?
Well, there's two levels of concern here. First of all, there's the international level, and the international level is really based on both the Russian and the Chinese saying that there's no such thing that a foreigner coming into Syria is not an option, that it should not happen, that any intrusion into Syrian territory can only be done with the agreement of the Security Council. So that's the international level. Now, if Obama does the same thing as Bush, in other words, does it unilaterally, then you have then to face the opprobrium from the Russians and Chinese and whoever else supports them. And the second, on a tactical level, you have to say, as you mentioned, you have to bring in thousands of troops. To first of all, you have to have the experts going to these 24 or so sites. It might be more or less, but at least 24 sites. And then you have to protect the experts by using thousands of troops. Now, how is that all going to happen? There isn't enough helicopters to do that. So what are you going to have, landing crafts coming in with these troops? I think it's going to be a very, very messy situation on both the strategic or international level and a tactical level. And I just hope that this is really being planned very carefully.
Well, Raymond Zelenskis, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure to talk to you again, Ian.
Good to talk to you again too, Ray. I've just been speaking with Raymond Zelenskis, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He was a United Nations Special Commission Weapons Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense. And his latest book is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. He has an article in the National Interest, Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about what the Keystone XL pipeline will be carrying.
So excuse me, Mr. Butter, I'm a Mr. Two, and you're giving Mr. Bad name, Mr. Like You. So I'm taking the Mr. from out in front of your name, cause it's Mr. Like You that puts the rest of us to shame. It's a Mr. Like You.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Sassoon, who is the publisher of InsideClimateNews.org, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that covers clean energy, carbon energy, nuclear energy, and environmental science. He just published the e-book, The Dilbit Disaster, Inside the Biggest Oil Spill You've Never Heard Of. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Sassoon.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
And, of course, you have an article in Tuesday's New York Times about this incident that we've never heard about, the Dilbit disaster. For the benefit of those who've not heard about it and haven't read the New York Times, Describe briefly what happened.
In 2010, there was an oil spill in Michigan into the Kalamazoo River of 1 million gallons of dilbit, which is diluted bitumen. It is a kind of oil derived from the oil sands or tar sands in Canada. And it was the first major oil spill of dilbit in this country. So why is this significant? Because the oil, the dilbit, reacts very differently in water than conventional oil, and nobody knew it. And while they thought it was being cleaned up, it was actually sinking to the bottom of the river. And more and more of this dilbit is being imported into the U.S., and the article that I wrote today was about the question of whether we are prepared for it or not.
Well, the oil from the Canadian tar sands that are being developed, and that is what the Keystone XL pipeline is all about, is about transporting that oil across the United States to refineries in Texas. What dilbit oil, that's the diluted bitumen, which is usually bitumen or bitumen, as you pronounce it, is what they use on roads, isn't it? Isn't that the tarry stuff that that they lay across roads? Isn't that what we're talking about?
The word is the same, and actually one of the byproducts of bitumen is asphalt. When you refine bitumen, you can extract large amounts of asphalt and sell that as a byproduct. I think in the British-speaking world, bitumen and asphalt are synonymous.
So, in other words, this is incredibly thick, gooey, gummy, viscous stuff, right? And my understanding from speaking with Bill McKibben, who led the demonstrations in the White House against the Keystone XL pipeline, he's flown over that area in Canada where they mine the tar sands and said it's like Mordor. There are vast lakes of black water, because the only way that you can get the tar out of the sand is through high-pressure steam hoses. And, of course, all that water runoff is polluted and polluted forever. So already extracting the oil from Canada at the top of the pipeline is in itself an environmental obscenity. But what you're saying here in your article in the New York Times and in your ebook is that this stuff, as it comes through pipelines, has to be diluted in order for it to flow through pipelines, and that's already been an incredibly serious spill. And the spill itself, those that were responsible for it, didn't know how to react, and they were incredibly slow in reacting. Is that right?
That's right. The ebook tells the story of what happened to the people in these communities when they were confronted with this spill, and what happened to the responders who didn't know it was dilbit, and how they had to invent methods to clean it up because they had never encountered it before. The book also talks about how the company did not reveal to the federal responders and regulators that it was dilbit that had been spilled. So it's quite a story about what happens to the people who bear the risk of these infrastructure developments that are increasingly being built to carry oil from Western Canada to U.S. and global markets. Over the next 10 years or so, industry has announced plans for 10,000 miles of pipelines so that the output can increase fourfold to almost or greater than 4 million barrels a day. And the question that a lot of people are asking is whether the regulatory systems and the pipeline safety systems are sufficient to bear the risk that this kind of oil poses to communities of people and the environment. And also, of course, water. I mean, the key issue on the Keystone XL pipeline that has drawn the most attention is that it's going to cut through the Ogallala Aquifer, which provides drinking water to 8 states and provides 30% of the nation's groundwater-sourced irrigation. So we know that Dilbit sinks when it's in water and is very hard to clean up, and it's been 2 years since the Michigan oil spill, and they are still cleaning up the river. So what would happen if there was an accident into an aquifer? I don't think anybody can answer that.
Again, I'm speaking with David Sassoon, the publisher of InsideClimateNews.org, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that covers clean energy, carbon energy, nuclear energy, and environmental science. He just published the ebook, The Dilbit Disaster, Inside the Biggest Oil Spill You'll Never Heard Of, and has an article about it in Tuesday's New York Times. Now, the National Transportation Safety Board just issued a report last month about the Dilbit disaster in the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. Fortunately, it was only it didn't spread further. But if they're still cleaning it up, and apparently at the time it happened, they were incredibly slow in recognizing that it even happened, and it took a call from a citizen to point out that there was oil spilling all over the place. I think they were like 17 hours later before they realized the pipeline had burst. And they're supposed to have sensors. What I get from your article in the New York Times, David Sassoon, is that because of the political clout of the oil and gas industry, they don't have to tell anybody what's in these pipes. And they say they have safety and alarms and et cetera, but the fact of the matter is none of that worked in this case. And so why should we have any confidence it would work with a greater volume once the Keystone XL pipeline is up and running?
The sensors that are used for leak detection relies on software, it needs to be interpreted. So it's not as if somebody is watching the pipeline with their eyeballs. What's happening is you have sensors that are sending information of many kinds back to a computer that has algorithms that interpret these signals. And then on top of that, if an alarm goes off, an analyst has to then interpret what the alarm means. And very often, an alarm can be triggered by an air bubble in the line. And so what our research has shown is that over the last 10 years, only 1 out of 20 reported leaks have been detected by these advanced leak detection systems that industry says can do the job. And the public at large has reported leaks at 4 times the rate. So the leak detection systems, while they are advanced, they are only as effective as the safety culture of the companies involved, and also in the way in which the software information is analyzed.
So, David Sassoon, the Kalamazoo spill, which they took 17 hours to acknowledge or realize it happened, by which time thousands of gallons and up to 1 million gallons spilled, the heavy bitumen part of it. Dilbit means diluted bitumen. They dilute it with chemicals. I'm not sure that we know what these chemicals are, but we know from the Kalamazoo spill that people in the neighborhood were nauseous and sick from the noxious smell. So tell us about what these chemicals are that dilute this bitumen so that it can actually flow through pipes.
The chemicals used to dilute bitumen are known as natural gas condensates. They are hydrocarbons, and it includes very often benzene, which is a known carcinogen, and other toxic compounds. So what happened when dilbit leaves the pipeline and enters the environment or water, these very light elements that are used to dilute the bitumen evaporate. And at a very, fast rate, 30% of dilbit will evaporate. And the heavier portion is about 70%, and that will sink because it's heavier than water. It doesn't happen instantaneously, but over the course of days or a week or so, depending on weather conditions, that's what happens. And anybody in the vicinity will be breathing in these harmful chemicals. And exactly what they are is a proprietary to industry. They are not required to disclose what it is, and they keep it secret for competitive reasons.
And 2 years later, after the dilbit spilled into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, they're still cleaning it up. So the cleanup itself, there was a 1980 law that created a tax that would be levied on oil companies if their pipelines broke and they polluted the neighborhood where the pipeline broke. Apparently, dilbit, which is going to be what's going to be coming from Canada via the Keystone XL pipeline, which everybody on in the oil business, with Exxon lobbying heavily with TV commercials and the Republican Party using it as a talking point in their campaign, that we need this tar sands. So the means by which this tar sands is going to be transported from the Canadian tar sands to the refineries in Texas is through the Keystone XL pipeline. If there's a spill, they're exempt from any excise tax that pays for oil spill-ups, because the law in 1980 was written, didn't consider bitumen and tar sands to be crude oil. So is that going to change, or are they just going to get a free pass?
It's hard to know. You're talking about the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. On every barrel of oil that travels through a pipeline, 8 cents is levied. And that 8 cents goes into this Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. And if there's an accident, or when there's an accident, the federal agencies immediately have a pool of money to tap to respond as fast as they can. And that's the purpose of the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. The trust fund was tapped in the Kalamazoo spill. The irony is that the spill was dilbit, and there is no excise tax of 8 cents on dilbit because it's exempt. When Congress passed the law, they did not consider dilbit or bitumen to be crude oil. So they said, no, the industry doesn't have to pay. I don't know if that will change. I do know that Enbridge is going to pay back the amount that was taken out of the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, which was about $50 million. The cleanup cost it's about $800 million. And most of that is going to be picked up by Enbridge's insurance policy, about $650 million of that. And then $50 million comes from the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, which they will pay back, and then the rest will come from their shareholders.
And Enbridge is the company that has this pipeline. But it's not the same as the new Keystone XL. That's a different company, right?
That's right. That's TransCanada. They're the two largest Canadian pipeline companies.
But just in closing, the whole point about this and why it's really significant is that the oil industry is aiming to fill about a quarter of America's domestic oil needs from these tar sands in Canada. So we're going to be getting all of this oil coming in from Canada. It's not really oil. It's bitumen, this stuff similar to the stuff that they put mixed with gravel, the tar stuff they mix with gravel to make roads. They, in order to make this stuff flow through the pipelines, because it's so thick and viscous, is to put chemicals in which are proprietary. They can't even tell you what these chemicals are. And then if there's a break in the pipeline, they, first of all, they don't have to pay into the fund because it's not because of a loophole in the law. So the oil companies get off free. And we don't know what would happen if the Keystone XL pipeline burst. Based upon what we've seen with this Kalamazoo leak, it's kind of a Keystone Cop operation. And, you know, they only seem to react after the barn doors open and the horses down the paddock and millions of gallons have spilled. And as you pointed out, there's this important aquifer that it crosses. And if that, if this stuff were, because it's so heavy, if we get were to get in the aquifer, that would be incredibly damaging. Just in closing then, David Sassoon, what is your recommendation for people to recognize the dangers posed not just in the production of this tar sand oil, which, as I mentioned, has hideous environmental consequences because of the enormous amounts of water used and wasted, but if there is, you know, a break in the pipelines that crosses the United States, God knows what's going to happen. But at this point, what the Congress seems to be owned by oil companies. What's going to happen? What's going to be done?
It's hard to say what's going to be done, but I think if the public is better informed about what is happening and the contents of the pipelines and the number of pipelines and the risks involved, to particularly to water sources, because these pipelines cross many, many significant water sources. It's not just the Ogallala Aquifer. You know, the public needs to know, and there needs to be an informed and transparent discussion about the risks and benefits. And we have to realize that the regulatory system has not caught up with the developments, these developments. And we also have to realize that leak detection technology doesn't work as advertised.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, David Sassoon.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with David Sassoon, the publisher of InsideClimateNews.org, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that covers clean energy, carbon energy, nuclear energy, and environmental science. He just published the e-book, The Dilbit Disaster, Inside the Biggest Oil Spill You've Never Heard Of, and has an article about it in Tuesday's New York Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.